Hello, shalom. My name is Nachum Amzel, and this podcast is What Does Judaism Say About? This is the full podcast. Today's topic is the Jewish view of, should we care what others think? As we were growing up, most of us heard a variation of the following rules from our parents. Do the right thing. I don't care what your friends are doing. You have to behave properly. If all the other kids jumped off a bridge, would you do it too? It makes no difference what other people think, as long as you do the right thing. The first two statements seem to be ideas that everyone can agree on. Act morally and resist peer pressure. But the last statement, is that really the ideal? Should people not care what others think of them or their actions? If each individual acts ethically in a given situation, but it looks unethical to others, should people still take that action? Is it really ethical and moral not to be concerned about how others react to the way people conduct themselves? Judaism has much to say about these questions and this moral issue. In Judaism, how people react to a Jew's action is indeed very important. The very essence of being Jewish is how one impacts not only upon oneself, but also upon others. Therefore, to consider the reaction of others as unimportant is to contradict a fundamental precept in Judaism, because it does not allow a Jew to fulfill his or her overall mission. The very first Jew, Abraham, is promised by God that he will be a blessing to all people of the world, not just for Jews. This indicates that others would aspire to be like Abraham. Every action that Abraham took was scrutinized by others, and rightly so. Had Abraham acted in a way that would have affected other people negatively, he would not have been able to succeed in his goal to inspire others to believe in one God. This is not just Abraham's mission, but it is also the mission of every Jew. Therefore, the Talmud explains how a person fulfills one of the main guiding principles of Judaism. The Torah states the Shema, the essence of Judaism, you shall love God with all your heart. The Talmud interprets these words to say that a Jew is obligated to act in a manner that will cause other people to say, how great is this person? How special must be his or her God to inspire such behavior? By learning and keeping the Torah's teaching, a Jew creates a Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name. Therefore, what other people think of their actions is certainly important in Judaism. The Midrash tells us that had the personalities in the Bible, such as Reuven and Boaz and others, known that their actions would be recorded in the Torah and scrutinized by millions throughout the ages, they would have acted in a much more careful manner, especially when they did not behave in a totally righteous manner. How people reacted to their actions was important to them, as it should be for all Jews. When considering the proper path in life, says the Mishnah, it is not enough that we choose deeds that will bring honor only to God. They also must bring honor to other human beings. Therefore, every time a person decides upon any behavior, he or she must be very conscious that not only is it the right thing to do in that individual's eyes, and even in God's eyes, but it must likewise be behavior that others will interpret as ethical as well. This concept, acting ethically in both God's eyes and in the eyes of others, is derived from the Torah story of the 2.5 tribes who wished to remain on the east side of the Jordan River when the 9.5 remaining tribes would cross the river and conquer the land of Canaan and live there. Even though they displayed the right motives, they had to demonstrate in their actions to God and also to their fellow Jews that they were ethical and moral in their decision. For this reason, the men left their homes and families to fight alongside the other 9.5 tribes for 14 straight years. It is a Torah imperative that Jews take into account how their actions are perceived by others, i.e. Jews must always behave in a way that is not only moral, but also appears moral to others. King Solomon echoes the same imperative when he writes that Jews need to be right and seek favor both in God's view and in man's view. Traditional Jews ask God to help them achieve this goal each day when they recite the grace after meals and the words, Be'inei Elokim B'Adam, in the eyes of God and other people. This concept of taking an action specifically to assure that one does not appear guilty in the eyes of others is an important one. So important that it twice saved the Jewish people in the desert. If not for this idea, the entire Jewish people, as we know it, simply would not exist today. After that first great sin in the desert that the people committed by worshiping the golden calf, God wanted to destroy the entire nation and begin again only with Moses. What was Moses' argument that saved the Jewish people from destruction? Moses tells God that if he were to destroy the Jewish people, the Egyptians would completely erroneously think that God was simply too weak to fulfill his promise to bring the people into the Holy Land, according to the Ebenezer commentary. And that this is the reason why the Jewish people were destroyed, rather than because of their sins. Though the Egyptians would have been totally mistaken to think this way, and God's punishment of death for all Jews would have been deserved, since an omnipotent God could certainly have brought them into the land of Israel, God relents and does not destroy the Jewish people in order to avoid a desecration of his name, Chilul Hashem. Moses uses the same argument less than 2 years later. The Jews sin once again in believing that the 10 spies' negative report about the land was true, and not having faith that God would be able to make them victorious in their conquest of the land of Israel. Once again, God wishes to destroy the entire people. This time, Moses spells out what people around the world would say if this were to occur. The Egyptians would say that God had some powers, but not enough strength to lead them successfully into the land of Israel, to triumph over the seven nations living there. As foolish and as incorrect as this argument was, God says to Moses that he forgives the Jewish people because of your words, Kidvarecha, the argument of Moses. Thus, how something appears is as important as doing the right thing. Even God changed his plans, and the Jewish people were saved because of how the situation would appear to the nations of the world. Although if he had acted as he wanted, of course, God would have been right and the nations mistaken. Rabbi Moses Sofer in the 1800s, one of the most outstanding and pious rabbis in Europe, writes that the most difficult precept he encountered in trying to fulfill all of Judaism's commandments is this one. It was far easier for him to remain clean and righteous in the eyes of God than to remain clean in the eyes of his fellow man. People are always filled with all kinds of suspicions and thoughts, even about rabbis. So a Jew must work very diligently, not only to be guiltless, but also to appear guiltless in the eyes of others. There are numerous incidents related in the Talmud describing how people and their families went the extra mile in their actions in order to ensure that they would be far above suspicion, even when they had done absolutely nothing wrong. For example, the family of Garmu that was responsible for baking the dough of the finest quality for the Lechem HaPanim, the bread of display in the temple. The rabbis praised them, because this family consciously would not allow any clean flour to enter their own homes, so that no one would suspect them of using the dough designated for the temple for their own needs. Abba Hoshea was a launderer who made sure to always wear clothing made of a special type of cotton not commonly found, so that people could never say that when he washed their clothes, he took little pieces of material from each of them and made a garment for himself. The family of Avtinas was responsible for mixing the spices that created the holy incense in the temple. The rabbis praised them because whenever a woman in their family got married, she would not wear any perfume at all at the wedding. And when the men in the family got married, they made sure that their brides would also not wear perfume. They did all this so that they would be above suspicion, that they may have used the spices meant for the temple incense for their personal use. Moses was responsible for both building the Mishkan tabernacle and keeping accounts for all the gifts and how they were used. Even though no accounting of each donation was required, Moses Moshe insisted on giving detailed public accounting so that even he, the great and respected leader, would be above suspicion that he took some of the donations for his personal use. The obligation to act in a manner that eliminates suspicion, even when a person does nothing wrong, is so important that Jewish law required that anyone who entered the temple area where the money was stored had to wear clothing without pockets or any other places that might be used to stash coins. Thus, the person had to go in barefoot, since coins could be stored in shoes. Similarly, one could not wear a coat or even an amulet or any other type of clothing that might allow a person to store a coin. In this way, if the person later became wealthy, no one could attribute his wealth to money stolen from the temple. The Tiferet Yisrael commentary points out that in all these cases, the people went beyond the original Torah requirement of this principle that was delineated in the desert, when the tribes of Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh wanted the land on the eastern side of the Jordan River, as discussed above. They asked to stay behind while the other tribes fought for the rest of the land. In that case, these tribes wanted something special and tangible for themselves, that great area of land on the eastern side of the Jordan. But they had to make sure that their actions did not appear to be selfish, subversive, or insensitive to others. And that is why Moses told them to fight alongside the other tribes before returning to the land and the cattle. However, in the cases delineated above, the people did absolutely nothing wrong or suspicious in any way and gained nothing. Yet they still took steps to ensure that no one could suspect them of any improper activity. This shows to what degree Jews have to care about what people think of them and their actions. Even when they do nothing remotely wrong or suspicious, they should anticipate what people might think and avoid any activity that could arouse suspicion in the future and compromise their integrity. Sefer Chinuch adds another layer to this sensitivity. If the person in question is very prominent, in addition to violating keeping clean in the eyes of the people, any action that wrongly looks suspicious also automatically involves the desecration of God's name. Thus, a Torah scholar, or today, anybody who appears religious, an observant Jew, has to avoid any situation that might even remotely look wrong, even if he or she is completely in the right. So if the Torah scholar is doing something that he knows to be moral and right, but it might look to others like a sin, he may not do it for both of these reasons. As a result of this concept, there are many instances in daily Jewish living when a person acts in complete accordance with Jewish law, halacha, but to someone else, a particular action might look like a sin that violates Jewish law. If that situation arises, similarly, the person is forbidden from doing the action, even though it normally would be permitted by halacha. When a normally permitted act is prohibited because someone else may think of it as a sin, it is called in Hebrew either marit ayin, the way something looks, or chishad, which means there's an imperfection. There are numerous examples of this in the Talmud, and in the codes of Jewish law, they are explained in detail. And as usual, there is some disagreement about the finer points of these laws, even though all agree to the basic principle. Only a few examples will be brought here. One classic case is the person who gets caught in the rain on Shabbat, and his clothing is soaking wet. It is perfectly permissible, according to the laws of Shabbat, to put these clothing out in the sun to dry without violating any Shabbat laws. But if people see these clothes drying, they may suspect that a person washed them on Shabbat in a machine or in a different manner, which is forbidden. Thus, the Mishnah states that any individual may not dry these clothes in the sun on Shabbat in a place where people can see them, because they might suspect that that individual washed them on Shabbat. But in the privacy of one's backyard, continues the Mishnah, the clothing may be laid out to dry. Another classic case in the Talmud is the person who lives in a corner house with windows facing on two different streets, something that's very common today. If that homeowner lights Hanukkah candles in the windows facing one street, he has completely fulfilled the mitzvah commandment of lighting candles for Hanukkah. But people who pass his home only on the other street will see no candles in those windows and possibly think that this man has not lit Hanukkah candles at all and has sinned by neglecting a rabbinical mitzvah. Therefore, our concept, caring what others think, even when doing the right thing, obligates him to light candles in both windows so that no one should think that he has sinned by forgetting to light the menorah. Other examples abound. For instance, the eating or drinking of both human and animal blood is not only disgusting, but also forbidden in Jewish law. But the blood of fish, which was used in certain societies as a delicacy, is permitted. If a person wanted for some reason to drink the blood of fish, it would be forbidden to do so, says the rabbis and the Talmud, even though there is nothing forbidden about this act. Since people might assume that it is the blood that came from an animal, it is forbidden. However, if there is some sign that it came from fish, i.e. some fish bones were right next to it, or other parts of the fish were lying around, and people saw this, then it is permitted. Similarly, if the coins of a person's pocket happened to fall on the ground in front of a statue that was an idol, very common in the olden days, which some people consider a god, then it would be forbidden to bend down and pick up your own coins. Even though the Jew had no intention to do so, others looking at this scene might think that he or she is bowing down to an idol, and thus it is forbidden. Likewise, says the Talmud, the case of a water fountain located near the statue of an idol. If bending down is required to reach the water, some may think that the drinker is bending down to worship the idol, and therefore it would be forbidden to drink water from that fountain. This is how far this concept extends, and how seriously Judaism takes this idea. Another situation which is very common today is the use of a liquid that looks like milk, but comes from non-dairy sources. In earlier times, it was milk that came from nuts or coconuts that looked like cow's milk. Today, we know that pretty common in stores is oat milk or soy milk or other milk that is non-dairy. Even though perfectly permitted in Jewish law, a Jew may not use this milk with meat because it looks like he is doing the forbidden act of mixing meat and dairy milk together. This law has very special applications and very practical applications today. When Coffee Rich, which is a non-dairy creamer, came into the market more than 50 years ago, it was forbidden then to serve that Coffee Rich with coffee after meat in a kosher restaurant or even in a kosher home, unless the container was left on the table, because people might think it was actual milk. Jewish law, therefore, required visible proof that no sin was being committed. Today, when almost everyone is familiar with the concept of non-dairy creamers and with the prevalence of oat milk, etc., people are not so quick to assume it is cow's milk, and therefore it is permissible to serve a non-dairy creamer with a meat meal even without the carton on the table. More about this particular case will be discussed below. Though not common today, since kosher meat that has already been slaughtered is already available, in the time of the Talmud before refrigeration especially, most Jews had to know how to slaughter meat in order to be able to eat meat following the slaughtering because there was no freezer or refrigerator to put it into. Jewish law requires that the blood of a slaughtered animal be covered up properly. Heretics and Sadducees, who did not believe in the oral Torah but believed in the written Torah, used to slaughter their animals in an open pit, which is technically permitted. But since this was the standard way that heretics and Sadducees operated, the Mishnah forbids slaughtering in this manner, lest people think that the upstanding Jew is also a heretic or a Sadducee. However, the Mishnah continues and says that if one does slaughter in this manner, in the privacy of one's own home, when no one can supposedly see, then it would be permitted. We will see below whether or not this idea and the laws of Maritayin and Cheshad apply in the privacy of one's home. What is the difference between the concept of Maritayin and Cheshad and its relevance today? On the surface, it appears that both Maritayin, how it looks, and Cheshad, we are afraid of this person because, are identical and seem to be used interchangeably in the Talmud. However, later authorities present three separate distinctions between these two concepts. Rabbi Abraham Tumim, who lived in the 1800s, writes that Marit Ayin is something that appears like a sin regarding a Jewish law that everyone already knows is forbidden, like the coconut milk mixed with meat, for example, because everyone is aware that combining meat and milk is prohibited. Since we all know the apparent sin is forbidden, this kind of action then, which is perfectly legal and moral but appears wrong, would be forbidden even in the privacy of one's home, since if people happen to see it, they would immediately question, how could this be done? It's not kosher. A cheshad, on the other hand, however, is an act that appears to be forbidden, but not everyone knows that it is a definite sin. Thus, this type of act is permitted in private, like the example brought above about slaughtering in the pit, or many other examples. A clearer distinction between these two concepts, based on the above notion, is a psychological difference in how the person seeing the action will react, which is relevant today as well. If a person watching you do an action that appears to be sinful or immoral, but is not in actuality, the person might think that if you are doing it, and since you are such an upstanding individual who always acts correctly, then this act must be permitted, since you are such a great person who is careful about Jewish law and acting properly, then this is a cheshad. So if, for example, the person sees you eating fish blood and thinks that Jewish law must be now that drinking animal blood is now permitted, since you're doing it, then it is a cheshad. But if the person sees you doing the act, is sure that it is a sin, even if it's not in reality, and will think then that you are a sinner as a result of watching this, then it is a case of Marit Ayin. Thus, since everyone knows that meat and milk is forbidden, by putting coconut milk into meat, coffee rich, oat milk, etc., the person will think that you have become a sinner. That is Marit Ayin. Both explanations are mentioned by Rashi, but Rabbi Moses Feinstein makes this distinction. Finally, Marit Ayin involves an apparent sin that is rabbinically forbidden, while cheshad can even involve what appears to be a biblical sin. The Encyclopedia Talmudit summarizes all three opinions and distinctions, and there are many practical implications as well. Now the question is, do these laws apply even in the privacy of one's home? In the Talmud, Rav made the statement that seems counterintuitive. He states that in the case of Marit Ayin, all Jewish laws that are forbidden because they look like a sin, even though technically permitted, are also forbidden within one's home, even in a room within a room. Why should something that is only forbidden because we are afraid what an onlooker might think continue to be prohibited when there are no onlookers in the privacy of one's home? Numerous reasons have been given. One is that if the rabbi is permitted privately, a person might forget and do it publicly. Others say that even in the privacy of one's home, it is possible that a nosy neighbor might see this action, even though a person thinks the situation is totally private. In the 21st century, this idea has proven to be a reality. There are many times when private actions in one's home, when person was sure that no one is looking, that have been captured on camera and video, either with a telephoto lens from far away, hidden tiny cameras that today can be the size of a fingernail, or on a cell phone camera that nobody knows is really turned on to video, or even from a very small remote-controlled plane that we call a drone, but is so small that nobody knows it's there. Therefore, we have to ask, is Rav's premise indeed Jewish law? Is in the privacy of one's home, may someone do something that is permitted, but appears immoral or not permitted to an onlooker? Rashi, in citing the Mishnah discussed above, says that the person may indeed dry his clothing on Shabbat in the privacy of one's home, but points out that this opinion disagrees with Rav's principle that says you may not do that. The Jerusalem Talmud also cites many instances when others disagree with Rav about this principle of not doing it at home. Tosfot commentary, in citing that there is indeed a fundamental argument between those who agree and those who disagree that this concept is also valid in privacy, add that even Rav would agree that the only time an action is forbidden in the privacy of one's home is it looks like a sin from which one would be biblically culpable. But for a sin that appears to be a rabbinic transgression, even Rav would agree that it would be permitted privately. This argument continues in the post-Talmudic period as well, with Rif and Rabbeinu Nissim disagreeing with Rav that Marit Ayin applies even in private, while Tosfot, Rush, and others agree with Rav. But what is the final halacha? Rabbi Joseph Caro, in his Code of Jewish Law, Shulchan Aruch, rules according to Rav. Thus, when people might suspect you or any Jew of doing something wrong, even if he or she is not doing anything wrong, it is forbidden both in public and in private to act in this manner, but only when the suspected sin would be biblically forbidden. This is good advice, especially in the age of the super telephoto lens. There are two other specific interesting areas where these concepts of Marit Ayin and Chshad have led to discussions involving practical implications for observant Jews today. We saw above that in certain circumstances, the rabbis obligated a Jew to do something, even though the act itself would normally not be required, but it was only performed because of what people might think. In those cases, would the Jew have to recite a blessing? After all, the only reason to perform these acts is to quell people's possible suspicions. Shulchan Aruch brings the case mentioned above of the person living in the corner house with two windows facing two different directions. While he obligates a Jew to light two menorahs, he writes that a second blessing is not said on that second menorah. But Rashba disagrees and says that a second blessing should be said as well. He cites the case of a cow that was slaughtered while almost about to give birth. If the cow emerges alive and healthy, there is a unique Jewish law that says this animal need not be slaughtered before eating, since it is considered already slaughtered, according to Jewish law, having been inside the cow while that was slaughtered, and is called a ben pakua. Nevertheless, so that people will not think that a Jew is eating a cow that was not slaughtered properly, or is no longer required to slaughter cows, since this Jew would never do anything wrong, the rabbis ruled that a Jew is required to slaughter even this cow, the ben pakua. Rashba says that the slaughterer recites the standard blessing on slaughtering this ben pakua cow that is recited for every cow that requires slaughtering. Why? Just as the rabbis require a blessing and establish so many other Jewish laws rabbinically, the idea of not appearing to sin, even when doing nothing wrong, is also a rabbinic law, and therefore you can recite a blessing. Thus, like any other rabbinic act where a blessing is required, so too would a blessing be mandated in this case. While it is forbidden on Shabbat for a Jew to ask a non-Jew to do certain prohibited Shabbat activity for him or her, it is permitted to contract with a non-Jew on Thursday or Friday, for example, to do such a job without specifying that it must be done on Shabbat. So therefore, if the non-Jew wishes to do it on Shabbat, it is completely permissible. Well, what if that work given to a non-Jew on Thursday involves working in the Jew's backyard, such as fixing equipment that belongs to the Jew? Won't some people think that the Jew asked the non-Jew to work specifically on Shabbat itself, and thus it would be forbidden as Marit Ayin? The Talmud asks this question and says that if the work, such as laundering or repairing a car that is commonly given in on Thursday or Friday, is done on the non-Jew's premises on Shabbat, it is perfectly permissible, since no one knows or sees that he's doing the work specifically for this Jew. But if the work is done in the Jew's property, or an area of town where many Jews pass on Shabbat, and they know the work is for that particular Jew, then it would be forbidden. However, in an area where Jews do not live or walk, it would be permitted. This is precisely how the Code of Jewish Law rules, and it coincides with the parameters of our overriding idea, that only when someone would think that the person is doing a forbidden action, even when this is not the actual case, would that action be prohibited. However, three sentences later, Shulchan Aruch discusses another case and brings a ruling which seems to contradict this basic idea. Some Jews used to collect taxes for the local governor from Jews and non-Jews alike, and this job entailed a seven-day work week. Since this activity was obviously forbidden on Shabbat, a Jew in this profession was forced to hire a non-Jew to collect the taxes for him on Saturday. But in this situation, everyone would see and know that the non-Jew is working for the non-Jewish tax collector on Shabbat. Logically, then, it should have been forbidden. However, Shulchan Aruch and Rima, Code of Jewish Law, both say that this is permitted. And they give a new reason for this. Failure to hire the non-Jew for this purpose would result in a great financial loss and possibly even the loss of the Jewish tax collector's job. Therefore, in this case, it would be permitted even though to other Jews, the non-Jew seems to be working for the Jew on Shabbat. This situation is technically permitted since the deal was not made on Shabbat or for Shabbat specifically. The idea that financial loss plays a role in the concepts of Marit Ayin and Echshad is already mentioned in the Talmud. But regarding this ruling in the Shulchan Aruch, the 20th century Rabbi Israel Meir Kagan writes at length and says that this applies only to the specific case of tax collection and should not be extrapolated to other situations that seem similar. Obviously, a problem of the 20th century, especially in many countries like America, there were many situations where Jews were forced to come and work on Shabbat, where it would be very relevant to hire someone to work for him that day, if possible. So the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Kagan, goes on and specifically mentions observant Jews who own taverns and bars, where Friday night is the busiest night of the week, and when the Jewish owners pay non-Jews to run that bar for them so that the owners could reap all the profits, they are engaging in a forbidden act. Rabbi Kagan explains that unlike the tax collection case, the work in taverns and the like is designated only for Shabbat. Moreover, in the case of tax collections, the non-Jew kept all the profits accrued on Shabbat, which would not be the case in the tavern. Therefore, it is not advisable for Jews to hire non-Jews to work for them on Shabbat. What about situations that relate today in the 21st century? The ideas of Marit Ayin and Chashad raise many practical questions for Jews of the 21st century as well who want to keep Jewish law. With modern inventions, many new situations arise where the actions themselves are not forbidden, but appear to be forbidden to others. For example, 100 years ago in the early 1900s, the idea of a Shabbat clock turning out the lights on Friday night in a Jewish home must have been a problem of Marit Ayin, because most people did not know yet that such a machine was invented. But now it is known that this is done in most observant Jewish homes, and therefore seeing lights go out in such a home on Shabbat would not raise any suspicion or cause Marit Ayin today. But concerning the subject of food alone, many questions abound. Would it be permissible to bake rolls to Pesach that look like bread, using matzah meal that is completely kosher for Pesach, Passover? People might think that it is bread, which is now permitted on Passover, or that the person eating such a roll is committing a sin, chashad. Similarly, food producers have created in the past bakos that look like and taste like somewhat like bacon, but are fully kosher. Is it permitted to buy and eat these? Clocks and other electronic devices can automatically do many actions that are forbidden on Shabbat, but machines are allowed to work on Shabbat as long as you don't touch them. While technically permitted, people might think that a Jew did perform these actions himself rather than relied on the machines and the clocks. Are they permitted or not? The rabbis of today have discussed these and other issues enumerated below. Already in the 1600s, an Italian rabbi came out against all this line of questions and issues. Rabbi Da Silva ruled that only those specific Marit Ayin cases mentioned in the Talmud and in the previous books of Jewish law should be respected and observed. But about new cases, such as baking kosher for Passover items that look like chametz, leavened products, already seen in the 1600s, one need not worry. The Encyclopedia Talmudit seems to agree with this overall analysis. Of course, many 20th and 21st century rabbis were asked specific questions and wrote responses that are very instructive, not only for Jewish law, but for ethics and morality of this overall concept. A few examples. Rabbi Moses Feinstein, mentioned above, the dean of Jewish law in the United States in the 20th century, writes about a number of situations which presented themselves and relate to the concepts discussed. Since a married Jewish woman who keeps all Jewish laws is supposed to cover her hair, according to Jewish law, halacha, many women today cover their hair with wigs made of human hair, which is permitted by almost all halachic Jewish law authorities. But what if the wig is so professional looking that it appears as if it's the woman's own hair? People might think that she is violating this law by not covering her hair, even though she is actually keeping the law. May she still wear the wig in this situation? Rabbi Feinstein says women may indeed wear such wigs today for several reasons. First, it is already well known that many religious women wear wigs in order to fulfill the requirement to cover their own hair, so that when most people see this woman and know that she is observant in all other areas, will not suspect her, and will also know that it's not permitted. Then he says that if one looks at the hair carefully, it is possible to see that it is a wig. Finally, he reiterates the words of Rabbi Da Silva and says that today we do not forbid what was not forbidden by the rabbis of the Talmudic or Gaonic periods. Another question asked by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein involved traveling in a car to the synagogue on Friday night after the time of candle lighting, but before sunset, when the Shabbat truly begins. Candle lighting usually takes place 18 to 20 minutes before sunset. A woman usually accepts Shabbat early when lighting those candles, but she can make a stipulation not to accept Shabbat then and accept it right before sunset if she wishes. Then, even after lighting the candles, she can legitimately, according to Jewish law, travel in a car along with a man who will accept Shabbat later, immediately following the afternoon prayer in the synagogue. The person seeing a woman in the car after the candle lighting, but before sunset, might think she is violating the Shabbat. Is traveling in the car at that time to the synagogue permitted or not permitted? Rabbi Feinstein says yes, and he establishes several important principles about Marit Ayin in the process. First, he generally says that a situation is considered Marit Ayin only when more than 50% of the time it involves an action that is usually forbidden, though the person doing it now, of course, is doing it in a permitted manner. That, as we have discussed, constitutes Marit Ayin. In this case, however, most observant people who drive their cars to synagogue after candle lighting time do so legitimately. Thus, this is not a case of Marit Ayin. Furthermore, he says that only a very small percentage of people will mistakenly believe that this observant person is actually violating the Shabbat, so that this case would not qualify as Marit Ayin for this reason as well. In general, when the percentage of people thinking that this is a sin is small, probably less than 50%, there is no problem at all of Marit Ayin, how it looks. There is also a question about the permissibility of going to the bathroom or buying a soda in a non-kosher restaurant. Jews who see an observant Jew with a kippah going into that restaurant for these purposes may mistakenly believe and think that he is buying non-kosher food, or in Israel that this restaurant is now kosher. So may a person buy kosher food that is sold in a non-kosher restaurant, like a Coke, or even go inside to use the bathroom there? Rabbi Feinstein writes that indeed this would be a violation of Marat Ayin and Chashad. But if this person is very thirsty, and there are no other places nearby to purchase the soda, and if there are no Jews in the vicinity, or no one he recognizes that would see him go in, then it would be permitted. If he sees Jews that he recognized, he should go over to these people and explain to them why he is going in, so they don't get the wrong idea. Another contemporary expert in Jewish law of the 20th and 21st century is Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. He was asked about a kosher hotel that serves that non-dairy creamer and coffee following the meat meal. As noted above, this is perfectly legitimate today, but in this particular hotel, many of the guests are non-observant tourists who, upon witnessing this for the first time, would probably think that it is permitted now to drink milk right after you eat meat. Rabbi Yosef answers that ideally there should be some indication that this is a non-dairy creamer or oat milk and not milk from a cow. Either that it is served in a separate kind of dish, or the packaging is brought onto the table. But even if not, since waiting 6 hours between meat and milk is only a custom, the real Torah prohibition is not eating them together at the same time. Waiting is only rabbinic, and waiting a few minutes between is sufficient from the perspective of the Torah law, not rabbinic law. It would not be considered Marat Ayin, says Rabbi Yosef. It could be served even without the container. With all these technical issues, one might lose sight of the overall concept that is crucial in Judaism. Jews should care what other people think and how other people view them. And Jews may not do anything which appears wrong, unethical, or immoral, even if it is completely moral and the correct action. Chasam Sofer reiterates how hard it is to fulfill this precept, but how important it is at the very same time. As we saw, even though the 2.5 tribes seemed to do everything right according to the directions of Moses, there still lingered some doubt and suspicion of their motives by the other tribes. And thus, even though they fought 14 years alongside their brethren before returning home, there still remains some animosity many years later. Thank you for listening and giving of your time. If you would like to respond or react to any of the points discussed, feel free to write on the group Facebook page, What Does Judaism Say About?, or more privately by email, whatdoesjudaismsayabout@gmail.com. That's one word, whatdoesjudaismsayabout@gmail.com. In addition, if you would like to receive a full transcript of this podcast, feel free to email me. Please subscribe to the weekly podcast so that you will not even miss one topic. Shalom.